Welcome back to The Civic Flame, the podcast where we take deep dives into the U.S. Constitution and how it does and doesn't shape our government. As always, I am Dr. Amber, and we are here going through this craziness together. Last week, we finished our long trek through Article 1, the powers of Congress and the legislative branch, which means that this week, we're starting Article 2, the executive branch, and arguably the most lawless and crazy branch of government that we have. As we go through the presidency, we'll be taking a look at how very different the reality of the presidency is today from the Constitution, and we'll ask whose fault that is. Now, I'd argue Woodrow Wilson, but really, I think we should all blame Congress. There are a couple of presidents we can really look at as starting this trend. Woodrow Wilson took a lot of power for the presidency, and he made the president something a lot more people noticed than before. As Article 1, Congress was supposed to be the most important branch of our presidency, and it was supposed to have the most power. If you look at it in writing, there are a lot of powers Congress has that the president doesn't. But since Franklin Roosevelt with the New Deal and Richard Nixon with the war powers, presidents have had a lot more power in a lot of different ways. And it's worth noting that every president, regardless of political party, has tried to maximize the powers of the office. And as I tell my students, the only thing worse than partisan nonsense is nonpartisan nonsense, because then everybody's doing it. So think about all the things you expect the president to do, the powers you expect them to have, and how you've seen them working with that power. Then, as we go through the powers the Constitution has said, think about the ways those powers might actually be out of line from your original expectations. And then we can decide who to blame for it later on. Grab a seat by the fire, and let's do this. Okay, Article 2, the powers of the presidency. I'm very excited because next semester, or whenever you listen to this, it's my next semester, spring of 2026, I'm teaching a course on the modern presidency. We're going to start with Teddy Roosevelt and work our way straight through to Donald Trump. And so it's going to be a good time to think about the structures and the powers of the presidency, who does what, when Congress has a problem with it, and when the courts have a problem with it. So let's go and do this. Now, I guess it's a good time to remind you that when it comes to powers and structures of government, I'm kind of a stickler for the Constitution. I think that there are a lot of times when the judicial interpretation philosophy of textualism is really used as a political smokescreen to take away the rights of anybody that are not politically popular. But when it comes to structures, powers, rules, I'm absolutely there with the text of the Constitution. I think that you need a textualism, a structuralism, when it comes to how the Constitution lays out the architecture. But I also firmly believe that a proper textualist reading of the Constitution would read the Ninth Amendment that basically says all the people get all the rights, and it's on the government to prove why they have any ability to tell us what we can do with our lives. But that's just me being a constitutional radical. This basically means that I complain about every president since, well, John Adams, who was our second president and definitely with the Alien and Sedition Act has some things we can complain about, but I'm going to give him a pass because, you know, he's my guy from Massachusetts. He's, you know, short like me. It works out. But for every president in the past 100 years, my complaints have been as much about how they've done things as what they've done. And in some cases, even more. Because when we say the end justifies the means in politics, it means something very different when we're talking about the structures of power that are left in place for whoever comes next, after you get your ends. The means will still always be available to the next guy in line. See, the law leaves a lasting legacy, and power likes power. So when you let the law change in a way that gives powerful folks power, it's not the person or the party that gets to keep the power. It's the office. So if you like the president and you give the president or Congress power because you like the people running the show or you like their political party or you hate the other guys just a little bit more, all that power is eventually going to go to somebody else. And sooner or later, it's going to be somebody you don't like so much. So for me, It's always about minimizing the powers of Congress, and especially the president, to keep it in line with the original constitutional reading, which basically means I'm that old guy shouting at clouds anytime a president does pretty much anything except stand on the balcony and wave at the public. Unlike Article 1, that is in 10 sections and took us a very long time to get through, Article 2 is only in 4 sections. So today, we're going to look at Article 2, Section 1. Next week, we're going to look at Sections 2, 3, and 4 all together. Why? Because again, they're short. The presidency isn't supposed to have that much power under the Constitution, so there wasn't that much space dedicated to it in the Constitution. Article 2, Section 1 starts with what's called the vesting clause, and it says, "The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States." Sounds easy, right? But by now you know that's just a trick. It's way more complicated. One reason this is distinct from our first Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, is that the Articles of Confederation did not have a real space for a distinct executive power as substantially separate from legislative power. The vesting clause is thought to set up the executive branch as separate from the other branches and to maintain that separation of power. Remember, when our Constitution was drafted, it was supposed to be a fix of the Articles of Confederation. But you don't stick a few dozen revolutionaries who just overthrew a government in a room and expect them to do what you say. That's just madness. They decided instead to scrap the whole thing and start over with the Constitution. But while the Federalists were all about this, the Anti-Federalists were pretty ticked off because they did not want any more government. French philosopher Montesquieu was the solution. His idea that power should be made a check to power inspired our separation of powers. The idea was that each branch got to have its own powers, got to have its own job, and got to have its own check on the other branches of government. They got their own carrots, they got their own little stick, and they got to go be happy and play together or fight. Right? They'd be fighting each other so much, in fact, was the idea that they'd leave the rest of us alone in our states and we could kind of do what we wanted. They'd be too busy fighting with each other to overtake our rights, and that was going to work out. So the vesting clause is a way of saying the president is a distinct part of the government with separate powers from Congress. The National Constitution Center online has several different discussions of the vesting clause, of the common interpretation of it, and of several interesting interpretations on it, and I highly recommend you head over there if you have some time. The next section says, "He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years and together with the vice president, chosen for the same term." This basically sets up the presidential term as 4 years, and there's a vice president. Originally, there were no term limits on the president, as Franklin Roosevelt figured out when he was elected to 4 consecutive terms. After he died, the 22nd Amendment changed that and limited our president to 2 terms of 4 years for a maximum of 10 years, assuming that the person died in office in one of their terms as they were vice president and took it over. The next few paragraphs talk about the weird electoral process before the 12th Amendment. And they add in some issues that we know today as the Electoral College. Interestingly, amendments to repeal the Electoral College and put the U.S. in line with every other democracy by using the popular vote have come pretty close to gaining traction. But Southern senators and congressmen usually crush any legislation or proposed constitutional amendment before it gains too much steam. At some point, we'll talk about the Electoral College, and one of the things I do tend to say is, I think that because it would be so difficult to have a constitutional amendment, a much better way would be to have each state do what Maine and Nebraska do, and instead of being a winner-take-all system, all of the electoral votes would be by proportion. So a third of California is Republican, a third of Massachusetts is Republican, then the Republican candidate gets a third of those votes. But 40% of Texas is Democrat. So you get 40% of those votes for Democrats. You can see why some groups would want this and some groups wouldn't. And you can also see why certain states would not go for it unless all states went for it at the same time. But it would put every state in play, and it would mean that whoever wanted to be president would actually have to appeal to all Americans and not just assume that they had some votes because they had the right letter next to their name and other votes because they went and promised them to people in swing states. But we'll talk about that another time. The next paragraph of Article 2, Section 1 talks about the time, place, and manner thing. We talked about this from Article 1, and it basically just gives the federal government power to set the dates for elections. As a reminder, if you go to the U.S. Code on Cornell's law school website, you can take a deeper dive into how these things are actually codified and set forth into policy. But now we get to the qualifications clause. No person except a natural-born citizen or citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who shall not have attained the age of 35 years and been 14 years a resident within the United States. Remember, from the last article, that representatives have to be 25 years old and a senator has to be 30 years old. The president has to be 35 and, different from any other place in the Constitution, has to be born an American. This is what crushed Arnold Schwarzenegger's political dreams after he went from Terminator to Governator. And that's not easy to say with a Massachusetts accent either. Too many R's. But it's an interesting thing because people talk about how old the government is now. But the president in our Constitution had to be 35 at a time when life expectancy hovered around 50. And for some people was a lot lower. The next part of the Constitution, aside from reminding us that our government is old, sets up the line of secession. Oh, no, I guess that does still remind us that the government's old. But it's changed by the 25th Amendment. This is the case where the president leaves office for some reason due to resignation, impeachment, medical issues, death. We have to know who to put in that spot. So we get the line of secession. Today, you can see that line by looking at the executive branch, all of the Department of, Secretary of agencies. So Secretary of Health and Human Services, Secretary of Education, Secretary of Defense, Attorney General are all in the line of succession. If something should happen to the president and they are required to leave office or there's some kind of issue. It's why at the State of the Union address, you'll always notice at least one member of the cabinet is missing. They're basically kicking it in a bunker and hoping nobody dies because that's just not the way you want to get promoted. The next section talks about paying the president. The president shall, at stated times, receive for his services a compensation which shall neither be increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected, and he shall not receive within that period of any other emolument from the United States or any of them. Like Congress, the presidency has what's called the Emoluments Clause. This means that the president gets a certain amount of perks, the White House, the Air Force One, and a paycheck for being the president, and that's okay. But any extra deals are not okay. This is why things like the Trump coin program that has the president invested in a lot of cryptocurrency is legally problematic. We don't know how much money's there. We don't know where it comes from. We don't know where it goes. And when you're trying to kind of keep tabs on all of these things in a transparent government, you really kind of need to know where it goes. That's how we determine whether it's acceptable or not. Now, if you're from the 80s and 90s like me, you're used to seeing these kinds of things from Donald Trump as well as from other billionaires, especially if you're from the 80s, because this is basically what happened with Trump Tower and Trump University. But at the presidential level, there is a whole different and more serious set of consequences that are meant to come into play for stuff like this. We kind of give a lot of pass to shady business dealings, no matter who's doing them, if you do it good enough, right? The courts don't always keep up with that fast. And there really is this American attitude of like, well, you got yours and you did it in the best way possible. But when you're representing the nation, when you're representing the federal government, those consequences and those issues are definitely viewed through a different lens. And there's a different set of laws that kind of govern what you're going to do. But it's unclear how much any of this filters down to presidential families. This is something that we saw with people talking about, like Hunter Biden was given preferential hiring in Ukraine and things like that. In the same way that members of Congress pass laws that financially benefit their families. For instance, Joe Manchin passed legislation that drove up the price of EpiPens while his wife and daughter had financial interest in EpiPen companies. There's a lot of investigation going on there. So there's also tacitly, that is silently, Congress has consented to the notion that emoluments don't necessarily count if they're not for you personally, if they're for your family. So Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, his wife made millions of dollars running a legal consulting firm for people who would go before the Supreme Court. Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law, was doing real estate deals in the Middle East, or Barron Trump potentially getting money in cryptocurrency or getting a seat on TikTok's executive board. They may seem a little shady to those of us who don't have rich parents, but they do seem to be just the way business works in Washington. And it's interesting to see the way that this kind of filters out, because I remember in the 90s, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton were getting into a lot of money troubles, particularly with like different savings and loan companies. And there was a lot of question about what was going on where and under what circumstances this would be unacceptable. And that kind of got washed out by the Monica Lewinsky scandal. But it's really been a longstanding question. I'm picking on Donald Trump because he's the president. If somebody else were the president, I'd be picking on them, right? But it's really interesting to look at how this filters down through different presidencies and the ways in which these questions continually crop up in different ways, just against that border of what may or may not be acceptable through the law. And it's tough to determine where some of these laws are, because again, the Constitution is not self-enforcing. And as I say to my children, it's only illegal if you get prosecuted. That's bad advice, by the way. Don't follow that advice. I'm not a lawyer. You'll go to prison. But the Constitution itself, it really is in some ways only illegal if you get prosecuted, because it's not self-enforcing. Just as Article 2 doesn't have as many powers, it doesn't have as many guidelines. And so it can get difficult and lead to real question marks. If you have a Congress and a president who like each other and therefore look the other way when any of them engage in bad behavior, or if you have a Congress and a president who hate each other and attack each other in motivated attacks, the Constitution kind of gets lost in the middle, right? The Constitution left ways to get rid of folks behaving badly, but I don't think they anticipated the number of people working in the government or the number of ways different people would behave badly. So it's kind of up to us to hold the government accountable, which is why we have elections. And I always remind people, House of Representative terms are 6 years, the president's 4 years, House of Representatives is 2 years, excuse me, the Senate is 6 years, the president is 4 years. That means that within a 6 year period, we could kick out all 435 members of Congress multiple times, all senators at least once, and the presidency. And I think one time we just should, to remind them who we're dealing with, right? Be like, hi, this is us, we're the problem. No, just kidding, it's you. And that they work for us. But I'm constitutionally aggressive that way. Maybe that should have been the name of my podcast. I'm constitutionally aggressive. And these guys get too big for their britches and they act like they don't owe us anything. Can you tell I'm still steamed that we're paying the House of Representatives for not working? I'd like to not work for 60 days and still get a paycheck. The last bit of the intro to the presidency is something you are probably familiar with. Before he enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. I was there in Washington, D.C. when George W. Bush took this oath of office, and it was cool because I was pretty close to up front. I was also there when Barack Obama said the oath, which was wild because my hip was in so much pain because I'd had to scale a barricade to avoid being squished by a mob on my way to the mall. But I was also pretty sure the oath had been administered wrong and everybody thought I was crazy. And then a few hours later, it was reported on TV that like there was some kind of fumble up and that he had to retake the oath of office. But I definitely recommend that you go to inauguration if you can. I wanted to go to all of them, but between having young kids and COVID lockdown and all of that, I haven't actually been to one since Obama. Maybe I'll go to the next one. Anybody want a carpool? But you really see the president having this kind of take care clause, which we'll talk a little bit about later. But he does swear to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And this is something, whatever form you work for the federal government in, you take some form of this oath. So when I worked for the Naval Academy, it was technically under the Department of the Navy and the Department of Defense. I swore to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and to bear true faith and allegiance to the same. And that is something that I took seriously then. It's something I take seriously now. And everyone who works for the federal government, whether you are in law enforcement or in the military or a civilian, you take some form of that. Like if you're in the military, part of your oath includes, I will obey the lawful orders of the people above me, and so on and so forth. And so it's important to notice that even as we have a even as we have a president, even as we have, you know, a Congress, even as we have a court, even as we have military governors, whatever, the Constitution is always what we come back to, right? That's supposed to be the touchstone that brings us all together at the end of the day. And it's why I do things like this podcast, because I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, because, you know, you just hitch your wagon to that star and you roll with it. Okay, that's it for the first section of Article 2. Next week, we'll cover sections 2 through 4 that deal with fun stuff like the State of the Union, treason, and the cabinet. Until next time, share widely and follow us on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Substack at Dr. Fun Sponge. In the meantime, keep the civic flame burning bright and take care out there. The Civic Flame is a Dr. Fun Sponge media production in coordination with writer Amber Veo and sound producer Matthew Munyon. As always, thanks for listening.